Hey everybody, this is Sandra. Welcome to show number 18 of Toon Talks podcast. While I was in LA, I had the great fortune of grabbing a quick chat with one of the most revered animators working today, Eric Goldberg. Most likely Eric has animated some of your favourite moments in animation, having brought to life the genie in Aladdin, Phil the trainer in Hercules, Lewis the crocodile in Princess and the Frog, and a personal favourite of mine, the flamingo with the yo-yo in Carnival of the Animals. I have the greatest admiration for Eric's work, which is why, even though I've seen him many times over the years, it took me 6 years to pluck up the courage to finally talk to him. I'm crazy excited to share this conversation with you guys, and huge thanks to Disney for allowing me to do so.
So, really, thanks so much for doing this.
That's okay.
I'm incredibly busy. Really appreciate it. So, every animator alive knows who you are, and I know you've been interviewed a ton of times, so I'll try not to ask you too many questions that you've been asked before. So I was wondering what the first shot you ever animated on professionally was and how it went.
Oh boy, okay. It was probably for a promotional toothpaste film for Procter & Gamble. A friend of mine named Dan Haskett was running a small animation studio and they were doing these kind of freelance things and he, he gave me some animation to do on it while I was in college. So that's probably my first semi-professional animation.
How long did it take you to do it?
Oh, a couple of days. Yeah. It wasn't a biggie.
Oh, that's good. How do you feel having an understanding of 2D animation benefits CG animators? And I was wondering what advice you might have for CG animators that can't draw very well, but still maybe starting up the 2D aspect before they go into CG.
Well, I feel like all the rules were created in the 2D vein, and that if you know those rules, if you know them well enough to absorb them and then not have to think about them, then it doesn't matter whether you're doing it in hand-drawn or you're doing it in CG. Then you can concentrate on the performance. Yeah. Then you can concentrate on who your character is and how that character's acting comes across on the screen. But principles like timing, spacing, squash and stretch, caricature, all those things that Frank and Ollie would have put in their 12 principles, it's all valid.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I think 2D has the advantage of in many cases is to be freer than CG. You're often limited by what the model and the rig can do in CG, whereas you're really only limited by the width of your pencil, you know, in hand-drawn. So it's often easier to do things that might be a little more unusual. You have to work for unusual in CG. Doesn't mean it can't be done, but it means it's harder to get to. And I think that accounts for a certain amount of reason why it isn't attempted as much, because it's harder to do in CG, you know. And I'm talking about things like animation cheats or slight distortions or things like that that help make the animation fluid. But, you know, in the brain of a computer, doesn't work because it isn't real, you know. And so you have to break some of those rules to get some of the same things that you can get in hand-drawn. But I think an awareness of all of that kind of stuff, an understanding of how and why it works in the 2D world, is 100% valuable in the 3D world, even if it takes a little more effort to get there, and even if you can only get there 50% of the way, at least you know what you're aiming for. You know the principle you're trying to do.
Yeah. Mark Oftedal was my mentor, and he was trying to get me to draw before I went into the computer, so do everything in 2D, but it took me a really long time to get over myself, because I couldn't draw, and I was like, oh my god! So, I feel like an awful lot of CG animators are saying to me the same thing. They're like, but I can't draw. So, what advice do you have for them? Just get over yourself and just draw badly, and is the timing and the spacing that matters?
Well, you know, the ability to draw is helpful in CG, absolutely. But I think the difference is understanding form and shape and design, whether you're doing it in hand-drawn or you're doing it in CG. In other words, if you can understand the beauty of an organic line that goes around, you know, a character's cape and up the back of the neck and all that, if you can understand what that looks like and feels like, you can manipulate your CG model to emulate that, whether or not, you know, you can draw it. If you understand what I mean?
Yeah, because
I think that you really, in both worlds, you're still dealing with form and weight and design. Yeah. And, you know, there isn't any reason, even if you can't draw, to not bear those things in mind as you are manipulating a model and a rig.
So I know that you do some 2D tests for the films before they come out now. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and if that's maybe your main job here at Disney at the moment, because people are always asking me what you're up to now.
I do a lot of different things, but one of the things I do is the occasional, you know, test drive on some of the characters prior to their being modeled and rigged. I did do some animation recently for John and Ron's Moana upcoming movie. I can't tell you what it is or what it's about. But I did.
We'll find out later.
And, you know, and prior to that, you know, I did some stuff for Wreck-It Ralph with King Candy and Sour Bill. And, you know, it's fun to do that because at the moment, at those times, the characters aren't fully established yet. And it's nice that they think of the hand-drawn artists as worthy of the exploratory pass, you know, so that we can take a crack at it, knowing that we'll approach it somewhat differently, and that informs what they might do with the characters then in the CG world, you know. With both King Candy and Sour Bill, they did use a lot of stuff from my tests, you know, that wound up in the final movie, which is great. You know, it's not the only thing that I do here. I do a fair amount of work with special projects. That's part of the company that's run by Dave Bossert, and he does an awful lot of work with classic characters, so every now and again I do things like that.
I was wondering how you come up with ideas, you know, because you do, like King Candy and stuff like that, the movement of that character, and your ideas are so fun and unique, and I was wondering if you have any advice for coming up with unique and clever ideas.
I think it always has to start with who the character is first. You have to know who your character is. If you want to use King Candy as an example, one thing that always I thought was a great animation challenge was that the character was crazy dangerous. Okay, on the one hand, he can be very charming in his craziness, and on the other hand, he can turn on a dime and be really, really threatening. And I think that's a very interesting character to deal with. So movement-wise, I wanted him to have bizarre movements. I wanted him to have gentle, appealing movements when he's being appealing. And of course, he really needs to be threatening when he's threatening. And, you know, I'm always looking for movements that are unique to a particular character, okay? So that each character has a sense of movement and behavior that you can immediately identify on the screen and isn't, you know, a generic walk or a generic, you know, way of folding their arms or whatever. You know, there's all sorts of different things that you can do to make your character unique. And it can come from, you know, the entire movement of the body to the curl of a lip. You know, those are things that all add up to the totality of the character that you're animating. You know, one of the things that a lot of people don't think of necessarily when they're animating dialogue and animating lip sync is that the mouth shapes need to be in character. The mouth shapes need to be mouth shapes that suit who that character is. You could not take King Candy's mouth shapes and put them on Pocahontas. You just could not. It wouldn't work. And likewise, the reverse.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're constantly, you know, adapting what you know about the principles of animation through that filter of the personality and the tone of the character.
Yeah. Okay. I was wondering if you could tell me what you feel the three most important things you've done in your career to get you to this point are.
Oh my gosh. One is stamina. Not giving up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the animation field has gone through a lot of twists and turns in the last 20 years or so, you know, and many people who were top of their game, you know, are unemployed right now. And then there's other people who you've never heard of and, oh my God, they're incredible.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of flux that's happening. And when I say stamina, I think that has to be linked with passion. You have to want to do this. You know, it's interesting because when I got into the business in the 1970s, animation stank. It was terrible. You know, the best I could hope for was the Care Bears movie or you know, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe or, you know.
I loved those, though.
No, well, okay, fine.
But yeah, I know they weren't exactly, you know, Pocahontas or anything.
No, but I had to seek places and ways that I could learn the best and do my best work, even if they were far afield. Eventually, I had to move to England and work with Richard Williams before I really, really started to learn my craft, you know. And at the time, there weren't a heck of a lot of expatriate animators, you know. It was pretty unique for somebody just to pull up stakes and move to Europe, you know. These days, we have really a global industry, you know, and through not just technology, but just people's willingness to go from one place to the other. It's far easier and far more common now than it was in 1977, you know.
That's true.
And so, you know, the stamina, the passion, and the enjoyment of it, you know, it's, if it just becomes a job, that's very sad, you know. And I think there's always something that you can find in it that's enjoyable. There's always a challenge. There's always something you've never done before. There's always some nut you have to crack to be able to do what's in front of you, whether it's a storyboard or whether it's, you know, animating a character a particular way, whether it's staging something a certain way. And so I always look for the challenges. I always look for what I can enjoy out of this, and to a certain extent, what I can master out of this. You know, one more notch in my belt, so to speak, okay? I'd never animated a character playing the trumpet before I animated Louis the Alligator, but okay, now I can. And it was through a lot of research and help from a lot of people that I learned. And, okay, you're not going to have a trumpet-playing alligator come down the pike for every animation assignment that you get. But for that particular one, you would do your research. So I went on YouTube and looked at Dizzy Gillespie's cheeks blowing out. We had an animator here named Russ Edmonds who played the trumpet. So any of us who had a Lewis scene where we were actually animating and playing the trumpet, good old Russ would come into my room and he would tell us exactly which fingers hit which valves, you know, for the notes that Lewis was playing and how his body English might work. And, you know, that kind of stuff is invaluable. And you don't have to go to those lengths. But if you do go to those links, there's going to be somebody who appreciates it. And not just, you know, a small, you know, niche amount of people who appreciate it. It's going to appear more convincing to the audience. They'll know that there's something authentic about it, even if they don't know what it is. You know, when we were doing Carnival of the Animals, co-director partner on Pocahontas, Mike Gabriel, well, whenever he was bored, he would pull out a yo-yo and start playing with it. So, especially on the dub stage. Anyway, so when we started on Carnival, well, that's the first thing I did is say, hey, can I shoot some video of you doing your yo-yo tricks? And I learned a lot, you know, the cliche way, and of course, since this is radio, it's not going to work, but the cliche way of animating a yo-yo is just to have the hand go up and down and up and down. But if you actually do that with a physical yo-yo, it'll just hang there limply.
Yeah.
Okay? What Mike showed me is that you have to twist your wrist, fling out the yo-yo this way, and then twist it back to get the torque on it. So essentially, I turned Mike's wrist into a flamingo's ankle, but got that same wrist and torque action that he was telling me about and showing me on the video. And, you know, that to me just says, you know, you've done your homework.
Yeah.
And that it does feel believable for people, that it doesn't feel like you're faking it.
Yeah.
Okay?
Definitely something special in there.
Yeah.
That's actually one of my favorite anime pieces of all time. It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
So in Clay's interview for the Animation Podcast, you were talking about Ken Harris and how he was able to get through like 30, 40 feet a week with the main keys and the breakdown,
mm-hmm.
and getting the, you know, the overlap in there. And I wanted to ask you about creating the perfect breakdown, because even in that, the flamingo scene where, you know, the poses are just incredible and the breakdowns are incredible. So I wanted to find out what makes the perfect breakdown.
You know, that's the interesting thing, is I can't answer that question because what you do in the breakdown is so endlessly variable that there is no such thing as a perfect breakdown. The breakdown defines the action that you are creating between the two keys. And so what you really need to do is understand what kind of action you want, you know, and make the breakdown reflect that. You know, do I want the flamingo to lead with his butt and drag his head on the breakdown? You know, there's all sorts of different things that you can do. Do I want, if the flamingo's having a take, do I want him to lead with his head and leave his body down behind and then that catches up later? I mean, there's all sorts of different ways that you can handle these things based on what you want for the performance of the character. Now, even though you can do endless variations on a breakdown, it still has to come from who the character is and what you're trying to get across. I've seen a lot of animators do interesting breakdown in order to make interesting actions, but the interesting actions don't necessarily work for who the character is. It's like, I'm teaching at CalArts this year, doing a fourth year hand-drawn character animation.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was one student who had an exercise where his character was walking off screen. And he did the poses great for the character walking off screen. And on the breakdown, you know, he threw the leg way up in the air, you know, and kind of twisted the body. So it resulted in a very oddball walk.
Yeah.
It was funny, but it was odd.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, why'd you go in that direction? He said, because it made me laugh. And he said, okay, but does it have anything to do with her attitude as she's leaving? Well, no.
Uh-oh.
And that's really what you have to be thinking about, is what you're putting forward for your character, what you're emphasizing about your character's frame of mind at that moment. And that happens not just in the breakdowns, but in practically all the drawings that you do. You know, many animators, Richard Williams amongst them, would say every drawing is an important drawing, and I don't disagree with that. You know, often I don't leave a lot of in-between to do on my stuff, because I'm always breaking it down and breaking it down and breaking it down and putting in these little nuances and variations, so that there's interest within the larger picture in terms of how the character moves. So,
well, I wanted to ask you as well about Snap and creating Snap in the movement. That seems pretty tricky for me. Can you give me any advice?
Yeah. Work the gap.
Work the gap.
Okay? In other words, this is something that they don't do a lot of in CG. For a variety of reasons. One is aesthetic and the other is technical. You know, one, you know, they tend not to, to use a lot of snap in most CG because it might look like a big jump for a realistically lit and rendered model.
Yeah.
Okay. Personally, I believe that you can and it looks fine. But often it's not done. And also, technically speaking, frequently with the production of a CG film, motion blur, one size fits all. So even if you make an interesting shape or something distorted, the motion blur will all but obliterate it, you know, by the time it goes through the pipeline. So the best way of handling gaps is with anticipation and then follow through. You know, so if you want to have a character, you know, do a take, okay, and say this is, you know, Tex Avery's wolf's head, okay, you might anticipate backwards a little bit and then throw the head forward with no in-betweens and then recoil back. But once you throw the head forward, drag the ears back this way and have them recoil and overlap on top of that action where his head is retracting. So you've got what happens before and what happens after for your eye to follow, rather than just making it look choppy. You're making the secondary animation work for you to make it convincing. Even though it's snappy, it's still physically convincing.
And what about appeal? What do you feel is appealing in animation and in a pose?
You know, appeal is very elusive.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
You know, and you know, it's one of the conversations I did at CTN yesterday, somebody asked me to define what I thought appeal was. And appeal doesn't necessarily mean that it's cute.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily, oh, look how appealing that drawing is. Yeah. No, I think appeal is interest. I think appeal is creating a character that is so interesting you cannot take your eyes off that character. And I don't think there's any better example than Disney villains. You know, Stromboli is an appealing character because he can turn on a dime. You know, he is massive and threatening, but he can also be old world Italian charming too, for that matter. Cruella de Vil, you can't take your eyes off her. You can't believe that she's that awful when she walks into a room. And those are definitely appeal characteristics because they are magnetic. Because of the behaviors and the movements that they determine for those particular characters, you know, you're mesmerized by them. So I don't think there's necessarily a formula for appeal, for a pose, or for a character as much as there is for the entire conception of a character.
What about appeal in the movement?
Okay. If I was to pick appealing animators, all right, probably my number one kingpin would be Freddie Moore. You know, and it was often said of him that, you know, he couldn't make a drawing that didn't have appeal in it. But he also did a lot of things to make his work appealing, and partially because he was so facile at drawing. So his drawing was very, very organic, you know. If you look at Mickey Mouse and the Little Whirlwind, for example, you know, those organic lines all the way down Mickey's head, down his back and around his shoe when he's doing a balletic pose, they're beautiful. They're absolutely organic, and he gets appeal out of that. He gets appeal with a certain amount of splay on the fingers and on the feet, that things actually taper outwards to make them look a little joyous, if you will. You know, and you can talk about it scientifically, but inherently there is just something in terms of watching a character who looks like he's having fun that I think certain animators do very, very well. And I think Freddie Moore did it and Ward Kimball did it. And, you know, to greater and lesser degrees, all the great Disney animators did it. A lot of the great MGM and Warner Brothers animators did it. But it's not a science,
yeah.
You know?
That's true. What advice would you have for pushing your poses?
Okay, well, I'll quote Art Babbitt, who used to say, go as far as you can go, and then go farther.
I thought that was Richard Williams.
Well, he got it from Art. Who do you think he got it from? Anyway, the fact is that you can be a little bit timid when you're trying to create a pose, especially if you're trying to create the pose. And often you can do a lot of drawing and throwing out and scribbling and erasing and all that kind of stuff. And that does stiffen up your work. One thing that I find is that I like to work very, very light and figure out what I want my poses and my breakdowns to be. And then I will go back through the whole thing and tie it down straight ahead so that it always goes back to being an organic thing where the previous drawing relates to the previous drawing relates to the previous drawing. And that way, it helps you push expressions or add more follow-through or things like that that you wouldn't necessarily have gotten if you just, you know, really tied down a resolved key.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. The hardest thing to do in animation is nothing. So I was wondering what your advice was for, like, just keeping things simple.
Well, first of all, your drawings... Well, okay, let's not even say drawings. Drawings or poses, okay, have to convey who your character is even when that character is in repose,
yeah.
All right? And when you say do nothing, well, it doesn't mean the character's really doing nothing. You know, if a character is listening to another character speak, well, you should be noticing little subtle reactions on the listening character, you know, and you can do that, first of all, with the raise of an eyebrow or the turn of a head, or maybe change a pose to consider something that's being said, or any of these kind of little tiny minimal movements that not only keep a character alive, that's the mechanical part, but keep the character engaged in what's being said to that character, you know? And there's certain timing issues. So, for example, you wouldn't want to have your character who's, quote, doing nothing, react at the same time as the content of the sentence is coming out on the screen. You'd have to give a little bit of a gap time, you know, so that you can tell the person has processed it, you know, before they react, you know. Milt Call used to do something that I call the take before the take, which is great, you know, where people's instinct. Say I'm facing right, okay, to you. I'm facing right, and I hear a sound behind me from screen left, completely on the other side.
Yeah.
Most people's reaction would be from this look I've got here directly into an anticipation and then turn around to react. What Milt and various other rather seasoned animators do is have them process having heard the noise for a few frames, like the eyes widen and the mouth drops, and then go down into the anticipation and turn. And that 3 or 4 frames of processing time makes it so believable, because you can't just turn, you know, without actually having to think about what you've heard first, even if it just takes a couple of frames.
Yeah.
So
what to you is the secret of animation?
Oh my God. I can't think of anything that's a secret of animation. I mean, the animation that I admire most is animation that convinces me that the animator isn't there.
Yeah.
Okay? Animation that convinces me that it's that character who is making his or her decisions, his or her thought processes, you know, his or her style of movement. The character is propelling the action and not the unseen animator. You know,
yeah.
I think when animators achieve that, that's the gold standard for me, is not knowing. And of course, okay, I'm a geek, so I'll sit there and watch a film and go, oh, that's a Frank Darma scene. Oh, that's an Ollie scene. But, you know, it's not that they haven't done their jobs, because they've done it so well, you know, that you really do understand who these characters are through their movements. And that was always the biggest thing with Disney, is understanding who the characters are by the way they moved. So that's not necessarily a secret, but it's my gold standard. Okay?
Well, what perhaps is the most important thing you know about animation?
Oh, boy. Okay. The most important thing I would say I know about animation is that there's always a new way to do something. And that's something that a lot of people don't think of. There's always a way to invent, you know, and I think that's so much a part of making the characters alive, is a certain amount of invention. I was showing some of my students last week a commercial animated by Russell Hall, who went on to animate Jessica Rabbit in Roger Rabbit. But well, at the time that I roomed with him at Richard Williams in London, he could do all sorts of different types of animation. And he had a series of commercials for Johnson's Cotton Buds, it's like Q-tips, with this little baby. Richard Briers was the voice. Anyway, he would, you know, look in a mirror and he'd study his own gestures and things like that, but he would do these graphic things. And one of the things that he did for a blink, just for two frames, is not show two eyes closed. It would be a slash across the head for two frames. And it looked great. And I thought, oh my God, here's a guy who's invented a new blink. This is amazing. And there is always something that you can do that is out of the ordinary, that makes it interesting, makes it unique. I think that kind of stuff is gold, you know, because you're dealing with graphics, you're dealing with movement, and you're dealing with what Walt Disney would have called the plausible impossible, okay? It can't necessarily happen realistically, but if you animate it convincingly enough, it's believable.
Let me see. What advice would you give to artists for creating their own voice?
You mean their own artistic voice?
Yeah.
I think an artist's voice isn't something that they can arrive at, you know, easily. It's not something where they go, okay, this is the kind of art I do. It's evolutionary, you know, and the thing about animation in particular, whether you're drawing or whether you're doing it in CG, you know, I'll use the drawing side for my analogy here. Yes, you can tell certain animators work by the way that they draw a particular character, but an animator's signature is far beyond the drawing. It's beyond, it concerns the timing, the spacing, the staging, the posing, all of the articulation, all of those things add up to what an animator's signature is. And I find that fascinating. And like it or not, like when I've done a couple of freelance jobs and I don't want anybody to know, hey, I saw your thing on TV last night. Shut up. But people recognize my work because it has those signatures. And, you know, I can't help it. And it's not something I do consciously. And I think that's one thing that makes the medium fascinating. You know, no matter how large these multi-million-dollar behemoth feature films are, you know, there is still the individual talents that make it up, and how interesting it is that each one of them has a slightly different approach. And I find that endlessly fascinating in the medium.
I was wondering if you could talk about one of the most challenging shots that you've ever worked on, because everybody finds it tough at one point or another, and
mm-hmm.
it's great when you hear about the legends having a hard time. So can you share one with us?
Okay, well, I'll give you a couple of examples of when I was a novice animator at Richard Williams, okay? One of the first, you know, you have to understand, too, that I had come over having worked with him on Raggedy Ann and Andy in New York, and then he invited me to come and work at his London studio on commercials. And one of the first things he gave me was I had to do a scene where a superhero's car was speeding into the gates of a stately home, okay? And I only had about 16 frames to do it, and it started on the hubcap, you know, and ended on the long shot. And I had no idea how I was going to do it. I'd never done anything like that before. And prior to my arrival in London, you know, Dick had told me, oh, this guy, Eric Goldberg, he's coming over and he's going to be really, really good. And he'll show you. He's really, you know, he's hot stuff. So anyway,
pressure.
Dick very patiently shows me how to plan the pan with the centers of each pan and the field sizes and the spacing on the car and all that kind of stuff. And I do it and I'm sweating bullets, and we have dailies every day in the morning. So I'm sweating my scene coming up. There it is. And I blurt out, Jesus Christ, it works! And everybody's looking at me like, this is the guy you brought over from America? And the other one was, the first actual job I did at Richard Williams was with a pot-bellied kangaroo who was kind of crude and boisterous. He had his friend named Snapdragon, and they were selling Walker Snaps as a potato crisp. And anyway, I was animating this hop on his cousin Bruce, the kangaroo, coming forward and hopping around him. And Dick gives it a flip. And he says, oh, that looks pretty good. You should show it to Art Babbitt and see if he's got anything to say about it. Hello, Mr. Babbitt. This is my scene. And Dick says, maybe you could look at it and tell me if there's anything wrong with it. Well, several things. All it took was one flip. All it took was one flip. But he was right. He was right. He said, I was doing the standard issue mistake young animators make, which is twinning on the feet going up and down as the kangaroo was hopping. And he said, delay the feet coming down by 4 frames. Boom, boom. Not both at once. And that made him more of a galumphing, crude character. You know, it was a mechanical solution to illuminate the personality of the character, and it was a great, great idea. So it's that kind of thing you learn from your elders, and you understand that's why they're where they are.
Well, we're soon to finish up, so I was just wondering, what advice would you have for your younger self?
What advice would I have?
For your younger self.
Be born 50 years earlier. you know, I don't, if I had to redo the things I've done, I don't regret any of the choices or paths I've taken, because they've always been interesting and rewarding and invaluable to my learning. You know, a lot of people would say, oh, well, you should have gone to CalArts. Well, okay, I didn't go to CalArts, you know. I was an illustration major at Pratt Institute. But you know what? That helped me when I got to Richard Williams and we had to animate every design style under the sun, you know. So you can't say one way is better or I shoulda, coulda, woulda, you know. I can't think of what I would tell my younger self, other than, you know, don't be such a jerk next time around.
Well, what advice would you have for longevity in the industry? Because you've kept going.
I think adaptability is a key thing to surviving in the industry. Understanding the turns, the aesthetics, you know, the way that the medium is going, and also understanding how you can affect that. You know, what can you do that people haven't seen yet? That people, you know, whether it's in the performance of a character or it's in the larger overall design or concept of something, you know, when you start doing cliches, you know, that's when it's time to hang up the pencil. I knew an animator, and I won't mention his name, who said, I have a formula for every single thing I need to animate. And I, you know, I never said to him out loud, but I was thinking, what a shame.
Yeah.
What a shame, you know, that you reduce animation to stock formulas that you can pick and choose. That's, you know, I always find so much interest in what I don't know and what I need to learn. You know, I mean, it was great for me on Princess and the Frog to get schooled by my other peer animators who said, you're drawing a very cliche gator here. It doesn't look like an alligator. And they were right. So I went back and studied, you know, live action gator footage on National Geographic specials. I studied alligator skeletons and muscular structure and redesigned the character to be much more of a caricature of an actual gator. So he felt physically believable as a gator. And even within the story content, you had to believe that he could actually get on all fours and be threatening as a gator at one point in the film. So, you know, you had to have a design that would accommodate both. And so it was great to learn that, you know, every now and again, and I think we all, you fall prey to it, you go with what's comfortable for you. And going for something that's not comfortable for you is where you learn stuff.
That's very true. I was curious, because you were talking earlier on about He-Man. Did you work on any of those TV shows?
I didn't. I was fortunate. you know, I escaped to London to work for Richard Williams while the rest of my friends were working on that stuff.
What were some of the ads that you worked on back then that we might be able to see? You worked on the Rollo ad, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a bunch of Rollo ads. And there was also Thompson the Cat for Thompson Local Directory. There was a kid's moose called Hippopotamus. Let's see, what else was there? There was, I'm trying to think. A lot of the stuff we did, as it happens, was for the American market, too. So we did a bunch of Pink Panther commercials for the Owens Corning Company, you know, who provide, you know, fiberglass for your attic for insulation. And we did all sorts of different things. And I did Busby. Busby was a bird who advertised the use of your telephone for British Telecom. I remember one time a friend and I, a guy named Teddy Hall, we used to go to this place in London where we could buy Super 8 films, you know. This is in the pre-VHS days, so we would buy an 8-minute reel of, you know, Alice in Wonderland, you know, and pour over it frame by frame, Super 8. So we went to this shop one time, and we were telling the guy who ran the shop, you know, what we did, and he says, well, anything I might have seen on television? And I said, yeah, I did a Busby commercial. Busby? I hate that bird. You know, British Telecom is spending all this bloody money on all this. Anyway, he took my head off because his phone rates were so high. And it's like, sorry, I won't mention it again.
You'd love to tell me what you've done. Somebody was talking to me yesterday, and they said to ask you for a voice because you do voices. And I remember from
Marvin the Martian.
Thank you. I remember that one from Clay's interview. Can you do another one?
Okay. I'll do Bugs Bunny singing.
I'm sorry. Am I just?
No, it's okay. Just an actor prepares, you know. Good night, sweet dreams. Tomorrow's another day. Till then, sweet dreams, sweetheart. Anyway.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, just for fun.
Yeah.
Just for fun. But when I did Looney Tunes Back in Action, I did do some of the voices. I did Marvin the Martian. I did Tweety Bird. I did Speedy Gonzales. You know.
Did you play Scratch voices together?
Yeah, I did all the Scratch voices.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, I don't want to keep you much longer, but thank you so much for your time. And I just want to ask you lastly, what was the greatest piece of advice anybody ever gave you, and who was it from?
Boy.
I'll be here for 5 more minutes just thinking about that.
The greatest lesson I ever learned was from Ken Harris through Richard Williams. And it's what you alluded to before, which is knowing exactly where to place your keys and then throwing the breakdown askew. So that when the rest of the in-betweens went in, you got automatic overlap. Mm-hmm. You know, and I detail it in my book, and Dick details it in his book, and all that kind of stuff. But that was the one where the penny really dropped for me, because it was the first, you know, many animators start animating by doing everything straight ahead, and I was no exception. I really hadn't graduated to learning how to animate with key poses and breakdowns before. Mm-hmm. And once Dick explained Ken's technique to me, that was when the penny dropped and I realized, oh my God, you can plan your animation. You can plan your animation to have it turn out a certain way, which is mind-boggling to a lot of people. I think that's the single most important lesson I ever learned in animation, was understanding, if I'll widen it out, understanding the importance of planning in animation. All the animators, all the directors that I've admired over the years were expert planners. You know, you look at a Friz Freleng cartoon and the guy, he's a musician. You know, he plans everything that he did musically, and it was unbelievably good and precise. You know, and that doesn't mean there isn't room for the happy accident or the improvisation. Of course there is. But just understanding how to map out something, I didn't really start to understand it until there was a time at Richard Williams when I actually had to set up jobs for other people to animate on. And all of a sudden I was put into that role of, okay, how do I set this up so somebody else can animate it? And you know, it all came in the planning the timing of the camera moves and all that kind of stuff. That was one of the great things about working at Dick's Place at that time and in commercials in general, is that it was guerrilla filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, you had to do everything and do it well. You know, when when I got handed my schedule for this Snapdragon and Kangaroo commercial, you know, it's a director, Eric Goldberg, at top, and Jill Purdom, who was one of the producers, said, yes, and if we miss the air date, the studio gets sued. And it's like, I'm 22. And it's like, oh my God.
Wow. That's what we learn.
And yet, you do learn that way.
Yeah.
You have to learn. I mean, all the old guys never had the advantage of video pencil testers. You know, we would see our scenes the next day in dailies, and by God, it better work.
Yeah.
And they always said, it has to be, you have to do it so that it'll work first time.
Yeah.
Because to that generation, there was very little going back and altering and changing stuff. You know, they had to live by what they put down and know that it was going to work. And that's the way I was trained as well. And I think to a certain extent, that gives you a great confidence in what you're doing. It has to develop over many years to have such confidence, but to understand that, yeah, what you're going to do is actually going to work, and you don't have to make a million tweaks on it, you know, is very valuable.
Yeah.
Okay?
Great. All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.